are necessary underlying substrate to behavior. Even if, and in the case of the monkeys, this is an environmental interaction. There's things out in the environment that are doing that, and the learning process is always this. But without, what they show is without the capacity based in this case, the dopamine receptors, you can't do it. Because doesn't matter what's happening in your environment. You can be given all kinds of opportunities. You can't learn if those dopamine receptors in the rhino cortex deep inside the brain are blocked. So this is what we mean by getting a handle on mental function, that everything we can do or imagine has triggers this biochemical electrical discharge. That is the material substrate of thinking. And my favorite example, as I mentioned in what I circulated earlier, is the experiment that's going on right now in Montreal with the nuns. The state-of-the-art machine for this stuff is the functional magnetic resonance imagery, fMRI, where you go in there and they ask you to think about something and they see what part of the brain lights up. So this is purely internal imagining. No external cue at all necessary for some of these experiments. And so they've got this bunch of older nuns who agreed to take part in this study, all of whom reported that at some earlier point in their life that they had this experience of the direct presence of God. It may have occurred differently at all, but this experience was essential for them in their decision to become a nun. And so the experimental protocol is to find out and ask them to think back and remember that experience, because they already know from studies of the brain that doing something and remembering it, they know how that is related, where it gets stored in certain places and so on. Try to recreate mentally, imagistically, internally, this experience of the direct presence of God, and they're going to see what lights up, and the hypothesis is it will be the same part of the brain for all the sample. The other one that I just got recently is using a different technology, but a similar one. They had a sample of 8 Tibetan monks and 8 graduate students who were not trained in meditation but said they were interested in meditation. They asked the monks to do a form of meditation which was objectless meditation, not to think about a concrete representation, but of the idea of compassion, of universal compassion, just generally. And they had them in the machines. And it was the difference. Of course, the monks are trained in meditation. There was this incredible difference in the scope of the firing of the neurons in the brain between the whole set of Tibetan monks and the control group. I mean, and the PDF file has lovely color pictures of these images, so you can see it. You can see what the researchers saw. And then within the Tibetan monks, the oldest monk there, who had done the longest time, I mean, his brain was just a glowing. The whole thing was just, as compared to the younger monks. So this is really interesting stuff, I have to say. But the point is that even the most abstract mental processes have at a correlate the firing of neurons in the brain. These are controlled on a biochemical level by chemical processes, by genes ultimately. The capacities to do this arise through genetic structures in the DNA. Of course, they can be trained and environmental interactions can change them, but the capacity to do anything like that depends on the biochemical structure that's available. So we'll find out what is the biochemistry of neural tissue that makes all of these things possible. And then, what would you like to do? So you'll find the reference in this new handout to a review from the journal Neurology in September 2004 with the title Cosmetic Neurology by a leading neuroscientist. And this is the abstract. Advances in cognitive neuroscience and neuropharmacology are yielding exciting treatments for neurologic diseases, like memory deficits and Alzheimer's. Many of these treatments, however, are also likely to have uses for people without disease. Here in this article, I review the ways in which medicine might make bodies and brains function better by modulating motor, cognitive, and affective systems. These potential quality of life interventions raise ethical concerns, some related to the individual and others related to society. Despite these concerns, I argue that major restraints on the development of cosmetic neurology are not likely. Neurologists and other clinicians are likely to encounter patient consumers who view physicians as gatekeepers in their own pursuit of happiness. So, in a nutshell, this is gene enhancement of mental function. That is, can I have a little bit more, please? Once you find out what it is, where the genes are, or what the genes are that construct these neural pathways in the brain, and what can make, say, more of them, if this is the issue, and how to do it. And then put up your money and get the intervention. So the two phases of this, which are actually referenced in that simple abstract, are gene therapy and gene enhancement. And they're as extensively reviewed in the paper. I'll just summarize it from a website. Gene therapy, on the one hand, is technique or group of techniques for correcting defective genes responsible for disease development. Mike has reviewed the way this is done, but in general, this can be done in a number of ways. First, a normal gene may be inserted in a non-specific location in the genome to replace a non-functional gene, and this is commonly done. Just stick in. There's a defective gene, just stick in a normal one and it seems to turn itself on. Secondly, an abnormal gene could be swapped for a normal gene. Okay? So you actually disable the abnormal one and you put in the one that works. Third, the abnormal gene could be repaired through selective reverse mutation, which returns the gene to its normal function, especially for single nucleotide diseases. Just do a little flip and you fixed it. Or fourthly, the regulation, the degree to which the gene is turned on and off of a particular gene can be altered. So these are four ways of gene therapy, and this is very actively being pursued. And this is a nice website which has some basically shows you how to do it. You actually use a virus to take the new genetic material into the cell. Sometimes it doesn't work and there are bad consequences, but they'll figure it out. Don't worry, they'll figure it out. It will be done and will be so-quote safe to do. There's no question, they'll figure it out. So use a retrovirus, which knows how to sneak into a cell, because that's what HIV does. HIV is a retrovirus. And take over the cell, and it'll fix up the DNA, and you get a repaired cell. And French researchers report dramatic results treating disease called severe combined immune deficiency, the boy in the bubble. It's a single gene problem, because it disables the production of an enzyme that's essential for the development of a normal immune system, so they have to repair that gene. They isolated a normal copy of the gene, packaged it into a vector like a virus, and then stuck it in bone marrow cells, because that's where the immune system is generated in bone marrow, and it worked. So that's gene therapy. Genetic enhancement refers to the transfer of genetic material intended to modify non-pathological human traits, that is, things that are not sick. Now, the term commonly is used to describe efforts to make someone not just well, but better than well. by optimizing attributes or capabilities, perhaps by raising an individual from standard to peak levels of performance. When the goal is enhancement, the gene may supplement the function of normal genes, that is, just make more. I'd like a little bit more IQ, please. Or may have been engineered to produce a desired enhancement, as you cause something different to happen. Furthermore, gene insertion may be intended to affect a single individual through somatic cell modification, or it may affect the gametes, the sex cells, in which case the resulting effect will be passed on to succeeding generations. That's the basic. In a nutshell, what I want to talk about in these two phases, with respect to social on the one hand and moral or ethical dimensions on the other in the next session, focusing on these concepts of gene therapy and gene enhancement, each of which raise certain issues, but gene enhancement obviously raises more issues, I think, than gene therapy does, at least for most people. Because even if you say that gene therapy sounds intrinsically good, you still would have questions such as who has access to it, will you have to pay, will it be available only to those who could pay for it, will you be, and certainly much of this can be done in the fetus before it's born. These manipulations, once you discover that you have a problem, you can repair it. I mean, as they do now, they even do operations on the heart of a fetus. But genetically, they already know a lot about how to do this, and will know more in the future, how to make genetic alterations in the developing fetus. Or by examining a couple's fertilized eggs by fertilizing in vitro in a laboratory dish, a group of eggs with sperm of natural parents, and then examining them for defects, selecting one, looking for defects, you probably couldn't use that with the technology is good enough so you can actually use the one you've examined. But checking, you're going to find out if you have the gene for Huntington's chorea is you need two copies of that to get the disease. But again, not everybody gets it. I think there's a high probability. I think it may be as much as 75% if you've got two copies. But there's some genes that even with two copies, you're going to have only a certain percentage of the risk that you may develop the disease. And so have a look first before you re-implant the egg back in the mother to see whether or not you've got a defective gene there. And then you can fix it either by adding, subtracting, or changing. And then re-implant it in the mother's womb. That will be the procedures for gene therapy. It's actually much, much easier to do at the stage of the zygote, the fertilized egg, when you have one cell to deal with, or two, the first division. Or in the fetus, much easier than dealing with already formed person, but you can't do it there, too. You can make the change once you have an actual living organism. So you have three chances to do this for correction of pathological conditions. But indeed, it is the... So maybe most people, and I want your views on this, would regard that as unproblematic. But when you get to mental function, you get more shadings of what is pathology and what is not. Should one want to say, once you discover what the genetic basis of autism is, and it certainly has a genetic basis, do you want to get rid of it? Maybe. People have severe social deficits, autistics have severe social deficits, much less so with Asperger's, which is high-functioning autism. They have a chance to live, much more chance to live a normal life with good therapy as in childhood. But and also, there are certain remarkable prodigies that result that are associated with Asperger's syndrome. So, do you want to eliminate all that? Something like schizophrenia? Well, most people say, yeah, you know, certainly paranoid schizophrenia, God knows, it's an awful thing. Has a genetic basis for sure. Faulty wiring, the genes don't do all the wiring they're supposed to do in the prefrontal cortex. And all of these admit have environmental interactions, but we're talking about now making these repairs in the zygote or in the fetus. Okay, what about depression? Get rid of that? Depression is certainly related to various anomalies in the neurotransmitters in the brain, serotonin especially. Too much, too little, not in the right place at the right time. That's why the drugs actually work really well, the SSRIs, which work on serotonin. If we knew how to do that, should we get rid of it? Depression is just, not very good for anything. And so on. Where do you want to go? And we're just talking now about therapy, about correcting what are regarded as some forms of pathology. Not any enhancements. So what other examples can you think of where you might be starting to shade into a gray zone for this? So I think that will be the challenge in what this art cosmetic neurology calls mentation. Cognitive function. If somebody comes along and says, I don't have as good a memory as somebody else, these things get inherited. I want my kids to have a better chance. Well, it's not quite a pathology, right? But, maybe it is. And it doesn't allow me to function cognitively as well as anybody else. So that should be fixed. Give my kids a fair chance. So I want to see what else you can think of where you might start to shade over. With gene enhancement, it's a completely different story. There you're talking about people who are classified as well in the normal definitions, who just want to be better. But as I mentioned, in most of the ways in which people can think of wanting to be better, these are competitive social situations in which a relative advantage is being sought, either in cognitive function, that is brain power, or in work habits, or in memory, then those are the mental ones, the physical ones are quite clear. But you see, if you can see the absurdity if you look at the simple ones, the muscle mass and athletic performance. The whole point is that not everybody can win. In competitive sports, so we're talking about competitive. Not everybody can win, otherwise winning is meaningless. There are only a certain number of Olympic gold medals, and there's one each 4 years in each form of competition. If my kid gets a leg up, where does that leave your kid, no matter how hard your kid works? I mean, if they can do in people, if you say the sports are track and field, if they can do in people what they did to the rats and mice, 30 to 40% increase in muscle mass, your kid won't have a chance if my kid's got that. And this is pretty simple. You may not know how to do this. And you remember what, in the paper, Sweeney, the scientist, said that ever since he started publishing this research about 3 years ago, half of his emails started coming in from athletes and trainers. Where can I get some? And if he replied to any of them and said, it's a long way from being safety tested and approved for use in rooms, I don't care, I want some now. As part of the mentality, which was reported in a U.S. opinion survey of athletes, in which they were asked, if you could have a therapy which guaranteed you an Olympic medal but would kill you in 5 years, would you take it? And half said yes. A bunch of those would think they'd be able to cure it before the 5 years was up, so, right? Take the gamble. But, this is going to be done. I mean, the anti-doping thing already looking for. By 2012, Dick Pound and the anti-doping agency for the Olympics figures, they're going to have to try to figure out how to do this. But think about this intervention is in the cell nucleus. There is no evidence in the body that this was done. You insert a gene which says make more IGF-1 growth factor. You can't, you can sample all the blood and urine you want, you'll never find out that manipulation was done. So all genetic manipulation we've done in gen. So apart from actually DNA typing and having a regulation which said this is a normal person with this DNA profile and this is an abnormal one because they've got an extra gene for this which we claim was inserted, there's nothing you can do. Yes?
Where do the cultural dimensions come in, where there's a culture that doesn't privilege winning above all else? Are those cultures doomed to extinction by these processes?
No. I mean, there are a whole bunch of interventions, which you could set the therapeutic ones, which might benefit in principle everybody. But I think, my own perspective is that we have a hyper-competitive society, but most societies have some layered structure in which there are people on top and people on the bottom, and some form for sorting out who gets on top. I mean, even in highly hierarchical societies and traditional societies, it's not entirely rigid. There's some movement between social classes, except when they're castes, as in India. So I'm saying, but you don't even have to think about it in a competitive scene if you don't want to. You could say, well, in principle, it'd be good if everybody had access to a gene enhancement. They'd be happier. So you could think of it in a non-competitive situation if you wanted to. It's not impossible that you could apply it there. I just think where it will be done is in advanced countries where the technology and the resources exist, and those are mostly competitive countries. So that's why I think it will be done there. So let's start, sort of throwing this around. I'd just hear what you think.
This goes back to the question that I asked you in the middle about the completion of the project, because I mean the story that you've given here and the projections of the ethical questions that will be faced, which I agree very much are there. But I think it's more complicated than what you're suggesting, and I'm not sure whether the complication is good news or bad news, and I'm just interested in your reaction to it. Because the picture you're painting is that we'll actually be able to say to people, look, if you want to have this trait, here, I can provide it for you. But I don't know if you read the article by Stephen Strauss, the Globe science writer, just on the weekend.
Yeah, out of here, yeah.
Okay. Now, I mean, these are very important issues that he's pointing out are coming up in the science itself, which is that at the molecular level and at this level at the genetic level, the issue of uncertainty, if not even indeterminacy, is much greater. The more we get into this, the more we find out that not only are there not single gene, most traits are not single gene related, but that most genes are the product of complex multiple gene interactions and gene environment interactions, and that the in fact changing one gene, which can predictably give you a change in a certain trait, is also probably going to be related to a lot of other traits that changes elsewhere in an organism that are unpredicted.
Yeah.
And that these are very complex, so that in every case you're not talking about, oh, if I want X, I can do Y to get X, but if I want X, I can do Y, which will produce a probability of getting X plus a probability of getting A, B, C, and D, which I don't want, right? And then other things which I don't even know what the results will be, so that it's a probabilistic game at best, even when the project is completed, and that's why I raised a question about that. Even when the project is completed, it's going to be a highly probabilistic kind of scenario about how to do a one thing to get a result. So that uncertainty becomes then a major ethical issue. How to handle the fact that you don't really have a good handle on what you're doing when you do one thing. Of course, Strauss's point was that what this is doing is throwing the whole theory of the Darwinian conception of how evolution happens into it's up for grabs now, because the notion of random mutation and then that mutation being selected for, and that doesn't even work in this picture.
Yeah, I don't agree with him on that point.
You don't?
No.
Okay, but I mean that's a separate issue.
Yeah.
But certainly the other parts that I'm raising about, you know, that this becomes a, you know, it almost begins to look like quantum physics.
Well, I would say that's a kind of reductio ad absurdum, and I think we already know enough to say it's not quite like that. What I would agree with is that depending on the complexity of the trait, it will be more, it will be very difficult, and maybe there will be more uncertainties about outcomes. But it depends on the complexity of the trait. Give you an example, and it combines this with the gene-environment interactions. Give us the muscle mass thing. An athlete gets this stuff that the guy did to the rat. Of course, it doesn't do any good unless he's in a training machine. It's not just the interaction. In fact, his research shows that. The rats are given this new gene, and then it turns out rats love to climb ladders. Then they're put through an exercise regime, intensive exercise, and they get the muscle mass. They wouldn't get it just with the gene. So in every case, you're talking about a setting of the gene manipulation and an environmental regime, whether it's physical performance or mental. It would say, well, if you boost your capacity for learning by working on the dopamine receptors in the rhinal cortex, then you got to learn. Then you have to be in a learning environment. But that's no problem, actually. It just goes hand in hand. You get this, plus you're told, well, you got to get this too, otherwise you're not going to get any benefit. But if you get both, you'll get the benefit. So that's yes, the gene-environment thing would be part of the package. Now, secondly, how probabilistic? Well, I suspect it depends on what you're doing. These guys, in the example that I read, were looking at a specific mental function in monkeys, and it's exactly the same in us, same part of the brain, same receptors, same neurons, everything's the same as in the primate. They found, they could manipulate a single molecular pathway, and they found a significant effect in a very important trait, namely learning in the cued reward thing. But I suspect that for a while, we'll have to discriminate between those kind of things in which you can find relatively straight line pathways, and the manipulation will be pretty easy, and where you get into more and more complex types of traits, and multiple gene interactions. But I don't really know, I don't agree with Stephen in the sense that this is a problem in principle. I think we will find the regulatory genes, we'll find the switches, and we'll experiment with animals, because we got the same brain as the monkey does, for all practical purposes. And we'll figure it out. And if it is probabilistic, well, we'll get the answer. You get an 80% chance of this. And then we'll tell folks, you got an 80% chance of this working for you, everything else being equal. So I agree that the issue is there. I don't think it will be an obstacle to completion of the project, and I think people will be willing to take the chances with those uncertainties because there will be, the benefits will appear to be enormous. So, but I agree that's quite legitimate, and I might be overly optimistic. So it is a question to be considered.
I came here thinking I'll just listen, and I quite enjoyed what you had to say. And I was like, am I supposed to do it? Thanks. I related to what you were talking about on a couple of levels. One is a former national team athlete and having gone through multiple lab blood tests on high endurance activities. And I, now being pregnant and thinking about having gone through amniocentesis, and I realized, well, smokes, I'm really involved in this in a way that I didn't realize before.
Yeah.
And I kind of tend to think that how this stuff hits the ground, I see it less, looking back on my athletic career, the number of people that were involved in that kind of participatory research in the labs as athletes is such a small number compared to the number of women who are, you know, sometimes asked, do you want this test, don't you want this test, and having gone through that, and living out in Deep Cove, I go by this billboard every day that, I think it's for, is it Trisomy 21? I'm looking at my friend here. The Down syndrome, mm-hmm. and the slogan that's on the television ads and also on the billboard is different genes, same value. And I'm wondering, same value.
And so what's the message?
It's got a person. It's got a child that has Down syndrome and a quote normal child together, or they have. They're talking on the television about the jeans that they're wearing. One is wearing designer jeans, and the other one's wearing generic jeans.
Good.
And they're talking about, and that's the slogan: different genes, same value. So my question to you is more like, are groups that are representing, like parents and children and people with such genetic anomalies, being proactive in trying to attract the public's attention to these issues, more so than, as you say, these hidden pharmaceutical companies or research labs that are doing this all, as you say, at a rapid pace that we're not aware of? Where do those groups that are actually like kind of public awareness groups sit in your view of things?
Oh yeah, there's lots of that already. I mean, I think that's a good example. The whole sort of zone of various handicaps, you know, is very sensitive, as we've seen in a couple public controversies. And so, yes, I think there will be people who have children or themselves have certain types of inherited diseases who might get a little scared about what appears to be a eugenics type of thing to clean up the genome. So I think that this will be part of the debate, and they will be interveners in it. In the end, I don't think it will stop some other people from, say, having their DNA scanned and rejecting defective tissue cells. If they happen to carry certain types of things that can be found and identified clearly. I think, and then there will be some who argue, I mean, we may get into this more in the second one, there is some kind of ethical impasse here and that we shouldn't go there. So I suspect.
Do you see it being waged, though, on billboards in the highway? Like, that's, I guess, what is interesting to me.
Yeah. Because we're just at the beginning. Okay. We've just scratched the surface of this. There, as I mentioned, in chromosome 7 alone, there are a couple hundred disease genes. When we get all this worked out and we have rapid testing, which we will get, you'll be looking for all of this stuff. And you may be making major interventions, probably in the zygote, could see this place to do it. you only got one DNA strand to deal with. Clean it up before you allow it to divide and go on. Either repair it, or snip it out, or put something in, or all of the above, and that procedure will get easier and easier. And then we'll have this. Now that's still not, in a sense, a eugenics thing. You're only, in a sense, I mean, many of us. Well, it depends how far you go. You know, if we're talking about just well-known disease genes that shorten life or make life difficult in some kind of not normal, like cystic fibrosis or Down syndrome, then you might say, well, we have an ideal of just a normal person, not an enhanced person, just a person without those kind of disabilities. Mm-hmm. And then there's probably a gray zone which someone can think of. You know, where do you stop? I mean, we can mention the aging stuff and the attempt to prolong life. That's an enhancement thing, though. So I think there's huge issues there. And there will be issues about fairness and equity in society, because will everybody have access to it?